This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
No introduction?
No. Do you want
an
introduction?
Lay it on thick. Okay.
Well, I
could
say something.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce Victor, who's going to be giving the talk today. Have you been the guiding teacher for this session? Or?
Yes, I was leading the... We just had a day and a half retreat, and I was leading it. And the group that I'm part of is called Canon Do, and they have a Buddhist temple, Zen Buddhist temple, down in Mountain View. And I guess I'm starting. Canon Do... Canon Do and Jikoji are really sister sanghas. Not everybody knows this, but a long time ago, in the 70s, when Haiku Zendo was around, and Koban was the teacher there, there was a kind of a split in the sangha, and Les K is the teacher at Canon Do right now. He wanted a city center, so he started Canon Do in the city.
Actually, if I could interject, Koban actually gave Canon Do to Les.
Okay.
At one time, back when it, before the new temple, when it was on off El Camino Real, that little space.
Right. Anyway, I'm not quite sure. Obviously, I don't quite know all the details. I wasn't there, but I know that Koban then came. He was more active here, right? Isn't that correct? He founded Jikoji, and he was very active here. Is that correct?
Actually, he had moved to New Mexico.
Oh, so he didn't do much with Jikoji.
Yeah. So here was run by Angie.
Okay.
He wasn't much.
Oh, okay.
And also Santa Cruz Zen Center.
He founded that
as well. And mm-hmm. Catherine Thanis took that
right.
over. And Les took over Canada.
Oh, okay. Mm. Well, we haven't had too much contact over the years. I don't know why, but I would like us to... Canon Do and Jikoji to have more contact. I think we're close. So it would be nice if people from Jikoji could go down there. I know you seem to do retreats every week. I don't know, you want to do more? I know, you want to do more retreats? I don't know. we do one day. We do very short ones, tiny retreats. But I would like to do more retreats here. I definitely like this place, and I would like there to be more of a connection.
I think, too, Jikoji is very much interested in inter-sangha.
Inter-sangha? Okay.
Yeah.
So good.
We'd be welcome that a lot. Yeah.
You're welcome. Okay. Yeah. All right. let's see. So a little bit about myself. My name is Victor, and I am from England. Raise your hand if you detected an accent. Zen people are very sharp ears. and I have been practicing Zen for 46 years. Oh, before I go on, I should tell you that the cook today is from England. The food you're going to be getting... It's an English cook, so I'm. I don't want to disparage English cooking, but I did see some spuds being made. You know, a spud is a potato, and I saw them being peeled. So you could be getting. I'm telling you, you could be getting bangers and mash. Maybe even fish and chips. I don't know. But so anyway. I've been back to my talk. I've been practicing Zen for 46 years, Although there was a 10-year break in there where I practiced about 5 minutes a day. And during that break, I studied and I actually studied and trained in the art of communication. I was very interested in communication. And with an organization, they were called Landmark Education. I know you might have heard of them. But they really are, I consider them to be masters in the area of communication. They're really good at it, really studied it a lot. And I'm also a math teacher at De Anza College. And I am married and I have a 17-year-old daughter. All right, so so my talk today is on communication, a subject that fascinates me. No, I'm not too good at doing it. I'm kind of a quiet guy, and every so often I kind of speak, and people go, "Well, what the heck? He just said something." But I do. I'm very interested in it, like how powerful it can be and why human beings have difficulty with it, because it does seem to be something we do seem to have a lot of difficulty with. And I'm not sure that Zen people are that brilliant at it, to be honest with you. I mean, that would make sense. We spend most of our time, you know, looking at a wall, so we don't seem to practice that too much. So when I was asked to give a talk here today, after reflecting on it, the idea of communication like popped into my head. You know, these things, it didn't seem like a regular kind of thought. It kind of comes from a deeper place. You know, these things like pop in. And when I thought, then the ego comes in and says, well, that's silly. That's not a Dharma talk, you know. But I tried to get rid of it, but tried to get rid of those the thought to do communication, but it would not go away. So I said, fine. Calm down already, sheesh, I'll do it, okay. We'll talk about communication, okay. So, you know, that kind of dialogue that we have with ourselves, that's kind of like a self-communication, right? Little conversation we have in our heads. It's maybe I'm the only one who does that, I don't know. So this kind of an automatic kind of thinking that some of those thoughts are automatic, but that other one comes from a deeper place, you know, that those thoughts are kind of, you know what I'm talking about? Those deeper thoughts. I always find that a sense of humor is like that. Like, I don't know, I say funny things and I don't know where it comes from. I don't, you know, I'm like talking, all of a sudden there's this thought, oh, I need to say something that's funny. I need to say that. And I say it and then people laugh. It's a interesting thing, humor. And I do love to make people laugh. I guess that's to do with, I don't know why I do. you know, it's the whole creative process, you know. You know, same with writing or art or anything like that. Creative, when you use jokes, humor, comes from a deeper place. I mean, so most of this talk will be on communication with others, not in my head. And I thought some history about my life might help to understand my interest in communication. So when I was a baby, I was left in a pram. This is in the 50s. And a pram, for those of you who don't know, is an English vehicle for children. It's basically, especially a stroller on steroids. That's what it is. It's... It's a freaking bed on wheels. So my mom was a very loving woman, but she was very busy raising my brother. And so what she would do, she would just leave me in the pram for long periods of time. And in those days, you know, there was not a lot to occupy a baby's attention. You know, there wasn't internet. There wasn't much. So I think I started meditating at a very early age. There's nobody here. Oh my God. And then when I was five, I went into hot. This is a very sad story, okay? So I'm going to try and make it funny, but it's pretty sad. When I was five, I went into hospital with measles. And that's a disease that not many people have these days, but my mother had the measles too. And I was put in a children's ward. My mother was put in a private room. We were separated. This is the 50s in England. I don't know. They had all these rules about contagious diseases. And I remember being taken to that children's ward, being in the bed in that children's ward. So if you can imagine a five-year-old child, very sick and scared, and then your mother is removed, taken away from you. And now you're going to some strange place. And I remember clutching my teddy bear. We were pretty poor. I think I had about two teddy bears. And I had this one teddy bear with me. And I had this vague thought that if I could keep my teddy bear with me, I could survive this experience. I knew it was going to go bad. It was bad. And then I remember them taking away my teddy bear. And I get sad right now. I seem to remember them, people looking at me and someone reaching for my teddy bear and taking it away from me. I never saw it again. And I think my mother told me it was burned because it was contagious. And after that, I have no recollection of what happened then. But I'm pretty sure that I went into some kind of like private hell at that moment. And I was always very quiet. So I don't know if I screamed or made a fuss. I was just quiet within my own hell, basically. And you know, when you're quiet, people think, oh, they're doing fine. And you get kind of ignored. You know, the people who make a lot of noise, they're the ones who get paid attention to you, right? So I was kind of ignored. As a child, family members would come over when I was a bit older, would come over and my brother and I would have to sit with them. And we were not really supposed to talk. In England, they had this expression, children are to be seen and not heard. So, brutal. So, that's what we did. So when I was 11, I loved the game of cricket. Now, cricket is a bit like baseball, but it only has two bases, basically. And there's always two people batting. One person's batting, and then you have a partner. And I loved this game, and I was really good at it. And then I went to the local secondary school and tried out for the team. But I played very conservatively. I kind of reasoned that they should just know who I am. I had this idea in my head that people should just know that I'm brilliant. I don't have to tell them. They should know. So I kind of played very conservatively and like didn't really do much. So I didn't get on the team. And I remember that was a devastating experience for me because I loved cricket so much. And I knew I was good enough. And then I didn't speak up. I didn't go to the coach and say, you know, I could have, now looking back on it, you know, as an adult, you know, I could have gone up to the coach and said, you know, I'm really good, you give me another trial, I'll do better. But I couldn't do that, and I was just so quiet and didn't speak up. And then it was kind of sad, because I used to play on Saturday, and then I used to go to the games and I had to watch them play. And then long to be so sad. So through these stories, there's kind of a theme, you know, that you might have noticed there's a theme there of being ignored and also not speaking up, not expressing what needs to be expressed to get what I want. You know, so I developed a kind of communication style, you know, of being very quiet. But there was another part of me that could not, the heart, you know, that deeper place, you can't suppress it completely. So I longed to express myself and be listened to. And every so often I would come out of my shell and people would be, and I'd say something funny, usually I'd say something funny, and then people would be kind of like, whoa, you know, what the? And they kind of, they'd laugh and go, whoa, Victor. Then I go back into my shell. So I have some stories about when these things happened, you know, when I came out of my shell. So when I was 10, everybody in the class was supposed to give a 5-minute talk on any subject. And I chose dinosaurs because I loved dinosaurs. But I could not keep it under 5 minutes. I just kept writing and writing. And I had pictures and all this. So my talk lasted about 20 minutes. And it was still not finished by the end of class. And then I had to take, and then the teacher said, so do you want to hear Victor's, do you want Victor to finish the talk tomorrow? And they went, yay. So I completed it the next day. It took me about 15 more minutes. And then I remember when I was 15, we had a substitute, this was in high school, and I did not like the person, because I was misbehaving. They got mad at me, and they said, "How old are you?" And I said, 15. And they said, "Well, you don't act like it." You know, it was kind of, they were kind of stiff. English, you know, stiff. So I said, "Yes, that's true. Many people mistake me for 17. The class was like, was in bedlam, you know, laughing. And so she said, "To the principal!" So I had to go to the principal. But you know, that was worth it, because that story got me a lot of mileage from my friends. You know, they were like, we talk about it. You remember the time? I used to hang out with the cool kids. They kind of liked me. I don't know why. I guess because of my sense of humor. And they'd be doing all the talking, and I'd be like listening. Then every so often I'd say something funny. And then at 15, I gave a talk at school on my favorite soccer team, Arsenal. Yes, who's an Arsenal supporter here? Raise your hand. Oh! Anyway, I have a funny story about this. Arsenal won the, this is not in my talk, this is I'm totally digressing. Arsenal won the, in England there's many competitions, not just one. And they won two of the best competitions in England. They won the Premier League and they won the Cup, which is very difficult to do. They won two competitions. And I remember getting so excited about it. I was in America. I was getting so excited about it. And I go out to people and say, "Hey, Arsenal won the double. They won two competitions." And these American people are going to look at me like, what are you talking about? I couldn't find anybody to share my enthusiasm with. It was kind of another sad story. There's lots of them. Oh, dear. Anyway, so that's... That talk was supposed to be 10 minutes. That lasted half an hour. I think talking about something you're passionate about, like it's really being real, being yourself, is so, I think it's enthralling for others. Now, I was just fascinated by Eric's talk last week when he was talking about nature. And I was just like, where did the time go, you know? He actually led us on a walk during our retreat, and talk non-stop about I was thinking, oh, there goes our silent retreat, you know. But it was good, it was fine. All right, when I was 18, another story, I took the drug LSD. And during that drug experience, I talked to people. And as I was talking, I became aware, as I was in the middle of talking to people, I suddenly became aware, I was talking, and at the same time, I was aware that what I was saying could be interpreted in different ways. That was like a mind-blowing to me. I'd never had that thought before. It was kind of a pretty mature thought for, you know, an 18-year-old. At 20, I decided to become a teacher. I decided I needed to get out of my shell, so, and also, you know, when you teach, you have a captured audience. No one's going to ignore it. They have to listen to you, right? See? So, mind you, when I first started teaching, I ended up being ignored anyway. They were like playing. In England, the kids used to play around like crazy. I think worse than Americans. Used to play around a lot. Anyway, things improved. When I was 21, I went to the only Zen monastery in England at the time. It was called Throstle Hole Priory. Isn't that a great name? Throstle Hole Priory, only in England. And it was very strict. Oh, by the way, an interesting fact about Throstle Hole Priory, it was the coldest place in England. I think they looked on a map and said, okay, where's the coldest place? That's the Zen center right there. It was very strict. Very strict, and we worked hard. And we're encouraged not to indulge in idle chatter. And, you know, at 21, I wasn't quite sure what this meant. But anyway, I thought to be safe, I'll just say nothing. So that's what I was good at that. And I noticed that the other Zen students would chat away a lot in their free time. And I was like very, you know, judgmental. What kind of Zen students are these? They're talking. And I decided I would not be like them. So I did not talk, and I became kind of lonely. Another sad story. And the and the teacher is interesting. The teacher at this place was like a salesman guy, and yet and he wasn't like a Zen teacher at all. He's like this, and there's a funny story about him. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And he was very funny, and he would give lectures every day, and they were kind of like the highlight of my day. And so this is, I want to tell you the story. So the story was that some Jehovah Witnesses came to this priory to try and convert people into Jehovah Witness, being Jehovah Witness. Can you imagine the gall? They came to this Zen monastery and they went to talk to them. And so the Zen teacher, he said, instead of saying, "Oh, get out of here, we don't want to talk," he said, "Come in, come in, come in." And they all came in, these people, all these Jehovah Witnesses, and he talked to them. He like talked their ear off for about an hour on Zen Buddhism, trying to convert them. You know? And they all left, running down the road, screaming, "Oh no!" Funny story. So, after 3 weeks of this not talking to anybody, I was starting to suffer. Oh dear. And it was not going away. I kept thinking, "Oh, if I meditate and work hard, it will all go away." But it wouldn't go away. So eventually, I told a monk, I said, "I'm going to leave." And he said, "Hey, why don't you want to talk to the abbot first before leaving?" And I was like, "What? Talking? Isn't that idle chatter? What?" I was very young. And and anyway, I just left. I was like, it was too late, you know. Like I'd already made up my mind that I was going to leave. At the age of 31, I came to America to Zen Center Los Angeles, which is in Los Angeles. I was there for 7 months. At the end of my stay, around about 1984, beginning of 1984, a student accused Maizumi Roshi, that was the Roshi there, Japanese Roshi, accused him of sexual misconduct. And if I remember right, I think she wrote it in a document and it was kind of circulated around. And it was like somebody had taken the finger out of a dam and the water came rushing through. You know, like what they're talking about these days, the Me Too, that Me Too thing. And everybody started talking about it, saying, you know, yeah, he did that. And then they started talking about other teachers and financial abuse. And I remember at the time thinking, I was kind of dumbfounded that so many, because the people there were very wise, very compassionate. How could they have been so poor at communicating? Obviously, this something needed to be expressed, something needed to be communicated, and it hadn't been. It was like a no talk rules. Kind of like, we don't talk about that. We all know it goes on. We know that Roshi gets drunk and collapses on the grass, but no, we're not going to talk about that. It's like, what is that no talk thing? So I left the center, not just for that, but other reasons, and started taking classes with this organization I talked about before, Landmark Education, and they specialize in communication. And I kind of learned a lot. I also did a lot of therapy, and the mixture of the three disciplines, the Zen and working with Landmark Education and therapy, helped me a lot with communication. I started to understand it better. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about what I've learned. So when I was a math teacher early on, I noticed that I would get upset with the students, what some students would say to me. You know, they could be teaching in middle school or high school. They can be very cruel and, you know, judgmental. And I would try to use Zen and like, okay, I just, you know, they'd say something and they'd be this upset. And I'd be, okay, I'm just going to be with the feeling. But meanwhile, I had to teach. You know? I'd be teaching being with the feeling. And then someone else would say something. It was like little darts they were throwing at me. It was kind of like a good teacher. And then in the break, you know, at the break, I'd like stagger out of the classroom. And I had this friend who used to work, who used to teach next door to me. We kind of like stagger out of the break and we kind of like collapse against the wall. And kind of, how's it going? Not good. How's it going? And then the bell would go, and then we'd go, back in! And it was awful. And by 1 p.m. or 2 p.m. of the day, you know, even though the day before I'd meditate like crazy, and then I'd meditate in the morning, by about 1 o'clock, they'd have got to me. And I'd be like yelling at him, you, get out of the detention. So now I've learned something from that. So I'm not sure if it would still work with middle school teachers, but middle school students. But I teach college. I do notice that sometimes they will say something and I will have a reaction. So I do try not to react straight away. And then what I do is I like to talk to them after class, or even better, the next day, and talk to the student and say something like, are you mad at me? And they'll say, why are you asking me that? And I say, well, you said this yesterday and I was kind of offended. I took it to mean this. And they'll say, no, Mr. Legg, you're cool. I like you. And then all of a sudden it kind of disappears. All that upset and kind of hurt and resentment, it disappears. And I don't know where it got me. It's, you know, it's letting go. As Dogen would say, forgetting the self. But it's, I don't let go. It, somehow something else comes into play when that disappears. It disappears, all the ups, it wasn't there, it's not there anymore. It's not like I'm holding on to something. I don't like going around saying, oh no, I'm totally okay with you. And meanwhile inside I'm going, No, it's gone, it is gone. And often it's, even they don't really have to say much, but it's somebody just observe their body language, you can say, oh no, they're not mad at me. And then that usually makes it disappear. Then you normally say a few things, but often the language is not necessary. I've learned when talking to a group of people in a large room to talk loudly and clearly. I hope I'm talking loudly and clearly. Raise your hand if you cannot hear me at the back. Okay, just checking. So I've trained myself to do this. But I've noticed that this might seem obvious in communication. If you're in a large room, you want to talk loudly and clearly, right, and articulately. But I find it surprising how difficult it is. At Landmark Education, a student, they train you in talking. Like you actually do public speaking, you stand up. And a student will be talking, and they'll be giving a public speech. And they'll be talking very softly. And the coach will say, okay, that's good. Speak twice as loud. Like get in their face and go, twice as loud. And the person goes, okay. And then they talk twice as loud for about a sentence. And then it would go back down again. It's almost like you kind of like to change your personality almost to talk louder. I have known several Zen teachers who talk quite softly. I think... This is my theory about this. I'm deaf, so I don't know. I like them to speak up. But I think when one is feeling peaceful, it just seems like natural, you know, you're kind of like, yes. And you get this peaceful smile on your face and you talk very softly. And and then, meanwhile, the people at the back are going, what the hell? Speak up! So... Maybe they're not feeling quite as peaceful. I don't know. So I'm reminded of the movie, Life of Brian. Regina, have you seen that movie, Life of Brian? That's a great movie. But it's made by this comedic group called Monty Python's Flying Circus. They were very famous in the 70s in England. They're very English. They're very crazy. It's very wacky. And the movie is about this guy, Brian, who was born at the same time as Jesus in the same place, whatever that was, Galilee or whatever that was, whatever it was called in those days. So it's very funny. It's a very irreverent movie. And there's one part of it where Jesus is giving the Sermon on the Mount. Right? And there's like supposed to be thousands of people at this sermon. You remember this one? This part. So the people at the back are like... They can't hear what's going on. So then once someone's going, what? They're speaking these English accents. What do you say? And someone's going, speak up! And then someone's, And then somebody says, what did he say? I think, he said, blessed are the cheesemakers. And somebody goes, what's so special about cheesemakers? Well, he's not literally referring to cheesemakers. He means all makers of dairy products. That was a great movie. You got to watch that movie. Oh, dear. All right, so as I've said earlier, I've learned to listen more. Another thing I've learned. Listen more to the quiet inner voice, not the loud, obnoxious voice. So in my 30s, I did a lot of substitute teaching. And this was after I got thrown out of middle school. Anyway, another sad story. I won't go into that right now. It was not going well, substitute teaching. I had all these theories about how the students should behave. You know, and I, gosh darn it, I was going to make them behave. I remember going to one school. I was teaching PE, and it was like the end of the day, and there was like 60 kids. And it took me 20 minutes to take roll. They were like moving all over the place. And then I said, okay. And then I said, let's do this. And they all took off, like about half of them, not all of them. They all took off and they all jumped over the fences and left. Substitute teacher, end of the day. We're not staying here. Oh, dear. So I was having trouble with this substitute teaching. So I was mulling over it one day. I was going for a walk, and I was mulling over it. What can I do about these substitute teachers? This is not working. This is not going well. And this inner voice said, do a rap. Like a little voice said, do a rap. And I was going, what? Are you crazy? You got to be tough with these kids. Don't talk. Sit in your seat. So, and then, you know, so my inner voice going, so that's stupid, stupid, stupid. And then I thought, okay, give it a chance. So I played with it. I came up with a rap. You know, about teaching at school. Do you want to hear it? Oh, God, why did I say that? So it started, it goes like this. Let me tell you, I do a little dance. Having a fit over here. I should charge for this. So I'll be here all week. They'd be like looking at me like, you know, I do this right at the beginning of class. I go, let me tell you about Mr. Leg. He's a real cool cat. Do you dig? Happening, rapping is his style. Listen up, stay a while. Math is cool, is what he says. Doing your homework really pays. So, you, and then I put the name of the school. Dudes and dudettes, you want good grades? Do what he says and you got it made. And then I go, wood. Thank you. Thank you very much. Where the heck are man? I've forgotten where I was. So, so then I have, like, oh, sorry, I know, let me see. So then I thought about this rap. Before I did the rap, I thought about it and I thought, okay, then I started analyzing it. So why is this a good idea? So I think this, students see substitutes as people to have fun with, and basically the class is free time. I mean, most. I mean, if you're in a good district, it's not like that. But in the districts I was teaching in, they thought like that. So they do not like substitute teachers because substitute teachers try to be strict and they try to be mean. So the students attack back, and they know the substitute does not know their names, does not know the rules of the school, so they know they can get away with it. So I realized that if I give a rap, it would get them on my side quickly, because they wouldn't see me as the enemy. Because basically what it was saying is, I appreciate your world. I appreciate it so much, I will completely come into it. I will actually do a rap. So they felt, the other thing teenagers want is they want to feel listened to. They want to feel appreciated and listened to, and most teenagers are not, are they? It's kind of like they're ignored. They're like, they're teenagers. What are you going to do with them? Kind of like that. So at the beginning of every class, I would actually go to the front of the class, and I would stand there, and I would introduce myself, and ask I would talk about England. They loved talking about England. They'd ask me questions. They'd say, do you still drink tea? Have you met the Queen? Stuff like that. And at the end of the introduction, I would do the rap. And that would seal it. It was kind of, you know, you start creating friendship, like connectedness to people, and then you do the rap, and that would seal the whole thing. And then they never, very rarely, they ever play me up after that. And then they would work for me. I've learned a little to speak up when an authority figure is being, shall we say, naughty. So as I said earlier, in Zen Center Los Angeles, there were no talk rules. So nobody talked about the Roshi's bad behavior. So speaking up to authority figures is a pretty hard kind of communication. I noticed that when students say something like they criticize me in some way, I notice how hard that is for me to take. So I can imagine when a Zen teacher feels criticized, it's hard for them. And then, you know, sometimes there's anger, and then the student, you know, gets upset, and everybody gets upset. And I think, I don't know, but I'm thinking it comes from growing up and, you know, criticizing one's father or one's mother, especially one's father, was a very dangerous act as a child. You know, the fathers would get very angry. So I think that childlike fear remains. I think that's a lot of why we have that, like a no-talk rule, kind of like we just cannot break out of that shell to talk to authority figures. But I think it's important. When I was told that Jokoji would like me to do a talk, I was happy about it because I like people to pay attention to me. Noticed? Then a few days later, I found out that I was not doing the talk. I was told I wasn't doing the talk. And I was upset. I thought, what? They think I'm Scotch mist? And you know, Scotch mist is the English version of chopped liver. You're getting an English education right here. But I did not stuff my feelings. I could have, in the past, I would have gone, oh, they hate me, I'm not going to do anything, I'll just put up with it. So I communicated, and I sent messages to Vanessa. Vanessa is the one who put on this our retreat. She was the one who, it was her brainchild, and she created it, basically. And we talked, and then they talked to Mike, and then I don't know who else they talked to. And there was still a lot of communication. And then it seemed to be that there was a miscommunication, and it seemed mostly on my part. So, and then the upset disappeared. Again, it kind of really just disappeared. And then, you know, when you let go of things, or when things disappear, then all of a sudden there's like a freedom, like a space for things to reappear. Notice that. And then all of a sudden, a few days later, they said, the talk's on again. You can talk. Oh, okay. what I want to say is that speaking up can resolve things. Communication can resolve things in a way that, for some reason, Zen, sitting facing a wall, doesn't always seem to do, and I don't know why that is. I mean, I would hope that it would. I mean, it helps, for sure it helps. But something in the area of communication which really helps. How am I doing on time? Am I going late, or what am I doing? I've got plenty of time. I'm buzzing along, okay? Oh, when do I end? 12:50 or something?
Really 12.
Okay. Oh, I think I'm going to be fine. All right, I can go.
Yeah, it's like the first, the second section of the talk, where it was going to be short, and then it got longer. Keep talking.
Keep talking. Okay. All right, then. I've learned that communication is far more than words. When one is really upset, trying to resolve it by email does not often work. Like, if it really is a big upset, I know it can be resolved by, like, little upsets maybe, but when it's really upset, if I'm mad at my wife, I don't send her an email. It's not going to go down well. I spoke to a Zen student the other day who'd been practicing. They've been practicing a long time, a senior student, and they said they were having difficulty over some issues with some other people. And I asked them if they talk to these people one-on-one, and they said, no, they don't do that. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, and their argument was, well, in email, I can express my ideas very clearly. which makes sense logically. But communication is not just about the words. And that's what email is for the most part, it's just about the words. Communication, I don't know, it's very mysterious, but when you're actually face to face with someone, there's all this, like, all these kinds of communication happening, body language, you know, smells, and hopefully not too many smells, but, you know, it's all kinds of things going on besides the words. So, So I wanted to encourage people to, when you're upset with someone, to have the courage to talk to people one-on-one, or even on the phone. Phone works pretty good. It certainly works a lot better than email, because you do pick up a lot of communication cues from phone, from telephone. It's quite a different experience. So many of us have experienced communication going on and nothing is said. When I was 17, I was playing cricket for my school team. I actually finally got on the team later on. And I was good. I was actually top. I had the top best batting average. Anyway. So I was playing cricket and we were playing this really good team. And I went in, I was like number six, because I was good, but I didn't speak up, so they put me like low down the order. They didn't really think, you know, Victor, he might be okay. We don't know much about it. So they put me down low down in the order. And I went into bat, and I was starting to hit him around the field. And I remember this friend of mine, he comes to, you play in partners when you're batting. And you stay a long time, you bat for a long time. So he came in, and we looked at each other. And I knew him. I knew he was good batsman. And we looked at each other, and there was this communication, which you get in sport, you know, like when you're in sport, everything, like your energy gets ratcheted up, doesn't it? Like the energy goes way up. And you look at each other and it's like, yeah, like, we're going to take this team apart. And that's what we did. We scored 50 runs, which is a lot at that age. And they didn't get us out. We were like retired, not out. I run an Airbnb business. A lot of people know about that nowadays, but that's kind of like a bed and breakfast place. But there's no breakfast. I'm cooking them breakfast. Too much work. And but sometimes the guests do not like the accommodations. I don't know why. And they cancel. Maybe it's the, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the bacon eggs they can smell every morning. I don't know. So there's a cancellation policy. And they can lose quite a bit of money by cancelling. So sometimes they'll book for like a month and a half, and then after 2 days, they go, I'm leaving. And there's a cancellation policy, and they can lose quite a bit of money. It's not like a hotel. It's more like a rental. And so one person cancelled, and they complained. They complained to Airbnb because they want to get the money. They know they've got to pay a lot of money. They want to get the money back. So what they do is they try to make out that the host, that's me, advertised the room deceptively, like I left things out, basically. So then they try and prove their case to the, so they call them up. They do it by telephone. They try to prove their case to the telephone, to the Airbnb person. Then the Airbnb person contacts me, usually by email. And then what I do with this person, one of these people, what I did the first time this happened, was I argued by email. Again, like this gentleman I was talking to before, I thought I could express my point of view much more clearly by emailing. So you see, the guest spoke by phone. I was communicating by email, and it was brutal. But nothing I said, it was almost like they were ignoring everything I said. And I was being incredibly articulate. I think I had a good case. And I lost the case. You know? The next time this happened, then I got wiser. So the next time, I thought, okay, so the guest is communicating by phone. I'm going to communicate by phone. So I did. I communicated by phone, expressed myself, and I was in a good mood. So I created connectedness with the person on the other end. That's important. So they were kind of like they were happy, and I was like telling, I told a couple of jokes. and I do not think my case was any stronger than the one before, but this time I won. So what my point is, you know, I'm emphasizing my point again that when people are upset with each other, you have to have the courage to get to face each other one-to-one. Now, maybe you can have a mediator. Maybe if it's too volatile, a mediator might be useful. I remember as talking about non-verbal communication. I remember that a Zen friend of mine, they were from England, and they were a senior student, and they used to do projects with the Roshi. This is Maizumi Roshi. And they would be doing something that the Zen student was unfamiliar with, never done this project with, but somehow they would be so connected with each other, the Zen student would know what the Roshi wanted before the Roshi had to say anything. They would like hand them the tool that they needed. So it was that kind of communication, very deep kind of communication. I have also learned that one has to be present to communicate effectively. One cannot be in one's head thinking about things. One has to be in a communication, Landmark Education put it as a kind of a dance with the other person. So I have a funny story to illustrate. This is a very funny story. I have a funny story to illustrate this idea of not being present. It doesn't, this funny story has a bad word in it. So if you are offended, this is the F word. So if you're offended by bad words, you might want to leave right now. It has to have the bad word. The story just doesn't go down as well. It doesn't have the impact. All right, so there's this actor who's very new to acting. They have one line in the play. The line is, it's a new play, new actor, and the line is, "Hark, I hear the cannon." And so they would, that was their line. And so they practice this its line over and over. You wanted to make a good impression in this first acting part. So you go home and you go, "Hark, I hear the cannon! Hark, I hear the cannon!" Then you practice that over and over and over. So then the day of the play came. So he's on set, standing around. Boom! The cannon goes off. He goes, "What the fuck was that?" Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I have another story. Another sad story in my life. When I was about 19, I had these cool friends. we used to smoke dope and do listen to In a Garden of Eden. If you remember that song. Go on and on and on. That thing. So when I decided to go over there one day, and I wanted to make a good impression because I was always so quiet, you know, and just listening to them talking. So I wanted to say something, you know, gosh darn it, I was going to say something this time. I was going to impress them. So I came up with something which I thought was really cool, you know, something. It was pretty cool. So I'd rehearse it in my head. It's kind of like this actor. I rehearse it. And then I go there and they were sitting around. I was waiting for a lull in the conversation, kind of playing on in my head. And then there was a lull, and I started saying this. It was totally inappropriate to what had been going on. But I started saying this stuff. And then I finished it. It was like sweat, you know, dripping down. And then it was like silence, you know. You could hear crickets going. And this friend of mine looked at me and he said, "Victor, that was really boring." It was so funny. All right, I've learned that listening is more important than talking. In Landmark, we would be trained to listen. I've noticed that Zen teachers are very good at this. But in Landmark, you get trained to listen so intently to the other person that you forget yourself almost. You're actually, as they say, you're over there and you're wearing their shoes. You're like in them, over there, experience life, what life is for them. It's an amazing experience. It hasn't happened too often for me, I can tell you. and it's so amazing that occasionally they'd be talking, you'd be like totally engrossed in them and what their world was like, what they wanted in their life. And then at some point, there'd be a silence. And then you'd be kind of like, "Oh, wait, they want me to talk." It's like a weird experience. And then you go, "Oh, okay, I'll start saying something." When you do that, I've noticed, when you really listen to someone else, Sometimes I do it at Starbucks, and I've noticed that when I do that, what happens, a side effect of listening is that you fall in love with the person. And also I've noticed that when you fall in love with people, life becomes more enjoyable. I'm going to cry. I've also learned that courage is important in communication. When I was in my 40s, I was encouraged to take up acting. People thought I'd be good at acting. And I always enjoyed acting. I have a captured audience to listen to me. They can't go away. They paid their money, they've got to listen to me. So I remember that I made a promise to a friend. I said I wanted a small part in the play. Okay, we'll start off small. I'll have 50 lines. That's it, just small. Just start off small. So I auditioned, and I ended up with this 500-line part. I was one of the main characters. And I was really successful. And I won awards. And it was really very joyful. I love acting. How are we doing? Oh, got a few more minutes. I've also learned that one needs to be really connected to the other person. In other words, you have to really like the person. Falling in love is good, but you can just respect them or like them. If you don't have that, then it's very difficult for anything meaningful to occur, any difference to be made with the other human being. I've noticed sometimes I'm talking to someone and I'll be talking and it's like my words are like going over their head. They're not hearing what I'm saying. And I think something's not right. And usually it's because I'm not connected with them. Like they're like, I have a neutral feeling towards them. Maybe not hate them, or it's like I don't feel there's no connection. And then you have to create the connection. Talk about, are you married or what's going on in your life before you can start talking about making a difference with a human being. I have another great story about that. It's from there's a show on Netflix called The Crown. Regine, have you seen the show? The Crown. It's a new show. It's about Vanessa has watched it because it's about the English Queen. It's about Queen Elizabeth when she was young. It's an excellent show. You see it. Only the English can do those kind of shows. Those historic dramas are brilliant at them. And there's one episode in the show. She's very young, in her 20s. There's one show about Nigeria. Nigeria is a country in Africa that England used to rule over. It was one of our territories. And at that time, it was in the 50s, and it recently became independent from England. And the president of Nigeria had decided that he wanted to cut off trade with England and wanted to trade with the Russians. So it was like a double whammy, I don't like you, I'm mad at you, and I'm going to trade with the Russians. I'll get you. So there was all this diplomacy and phone calls and telegrams. They used to talk by telegrams in those days to try and get this president to resume trade with England. And nothing was working. And the Queen knew about it. And she decided, I'm going to go to Nigeria, make a difference. And everybody said, no, that's not a good idea. You don't want to do that. No. And she said, no, I'm going. And she went. And she talked to him, this president, and it didn't make a difference. She was talking to him, And then there was this, and everybody was going, it's not going to work. We're not going to make a difference here. And then there was this dance, a dinner dance at the, it was the last day, near the end of her visit. And the president and all his entourage were over one side of the room, and the queen and her entourage were over this other side of the room, kind of separated. Nobody was dancing. And she spoke to one of her group, and she said, go over to the president and ask him if he'd like to dance with me. So the guy went over there, spoke to the president, and the president's face beamed. Because he's going to dance. This is a black man going to dance with this white, very powerful queen of this empire. And she was asking him to dance with her. So they got up and danced and created so that when you hold someone, that creates a lot of relationship, right? And he felt acknowledged, he felt accepted, he felt appreciated, and that was enough. and trade was resumed between England and Nigeria. So I think the moral is, let's have more women leaders who are good at dancing, something. Finally, I want to end with about my wife. So I've noticed also, I've learned that women talk differently than men. Women talk a lot to create connect. It's natural for women, I think, to create connectedness, relationship with others. Men, it's not so natural. So the content often is not so important with a woman. It's more about the relationship. So my wife, sometimes I'll be in the kitchen, and next to the kitchen is the living room where the TV is, and she'll come into the kitchen and she'll announce to me. She says, "I am going to watch TV now, and then I'm going to go to bed early." And I go, "Okay. Why are you telling me this? You're obviously going to do that in about 5 seconds. I can see you doing it." This is the way men think, you know. But then I think, then I mull it over a bit. I have to mull it over, you see. And I realize she's speaking in code. Women speak in code. They do. And men have to break the code. It's so hard for us. She likes them. So she is saying, "I love you." That is what that's the code. She says, "I love you. I want to connect with you." And that, my friends, pretty much sums up what communication is all about. And that's it. We're done here. Thank you so much. So I'm not sure that was a Dharma talk or stand-up comedy. We're done.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.